Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi and welcome to The Backstory with Claire
and Susie. In each episode, we'll be hearing about an experience that has happened to someone that shaped who they are.
30 minutes that remind us that everyone's dealing with something. So we're a documentary podcast, a docupod.
Except you made that word up. Okay, so I'm going to give you a bit of an intro to Naomi because she's definitely a woman of many talents. She's essentially a performer and she's had this really varied and very interesting background in the theatre. She also has an incredibly niche PhD looking at the role of actors and actresses in the suffrage movement. So there you go, that's a new one on me.
And to start off with, we thought she was two people, didn't we? Because she was aide-de-camp.
Yeah, she has this kind of alter ego aide-de-camp as well. But, you know, we really didn't have time to cover everything. Today's backstory, basically, we start off hearing a little bit about what drew Naomi to the theatre. But then we move on to, you know, what's the meat of the story, which is time she spent in a Romanian orphanage with young people with learning disabilities. Just a quick heads up, the conditions she describes are pretty hard to hear about.
Yeah, I was expecting that because many of us will remember those images from 1989 when the world first became aware of like these conditions in the Romanian orphanages. And just how dreadful the lives were for the children who were living there.
Yeah, and obviously with Naomi, the children that she was working with were born, you know, I'm guessing sort of post 2000. So it just demonstrates how, you know, these issues are longstanding.
They haven't gone away yet. So this is a bit of a different one because we're talking about Naomi's professional life, but I think that's a good thing because our working lives are a big part of who we are and they're part of our identity and part of our backstory.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway, see what you think and we'll talk afterwards. Here's Naomi. I'm here with Naomi Paxton, a.k.a. Ada Camp. Hi, Naomi.
Hello, hello.
So if you cast your mind back over kind of the course of your life and think about, you know, those peaks and troughs and all the little bits in between, can you think of a time that feels significant to you and can you think of something you'd like to tell us about?
I think probably the first significant thing I can think about is when I first realised how much I loved theatre and what the possibilities might be.
Okay.
It's kind of a combination of two things. I'm sneaking them in.
Yeah, but
I think I was nearly the same age. So the first one was I went to see a pantomime at our local theatre and I loved pantomime.
Okay.
But I remember being in the audience and probably about seven-ish, looking out and seeing Cinderella or Snow White, whoever it was on stage, and thinking, my gosh, she's so amazingly beautiful and being charmed by it all. And then when they asked for kids, I whipped my hand up and went on stage. And
You got picked.
I got picked.
Yeah.
And went on stage. And when I got up close, I could see how much makeup she had on. And I could see how much makeup everybody had on.
Right.
And I was like, oh, they're not beautiful.
Oh.
They've got makeup on. And that's wonderful.
Okay.
And everybody else still thinks they're really beautiful. But I'm here and I know that they're not. They're just people, but they've made themselves look beautiful. And that had a real... I remember thinking, being thrilled by the possibility of that one wasn't kind of held to one's own appearance.
Because if they can wear makeup and look beautiful, then
yeah,
anyone can wear
it. I think so. And because I was a very hard child of kind of divorced parents, I was very hung up on the fact that I looked like the parent I didn't live with.
Okay.
And I'm always hated the way I looked, I think. And it was something about that, I think, probably in that moment that was like, oh gosh, you don't have to be held back or defined by this.
Wow. How old were you?
I think probably about 7.
Right.
And then the second one is probably about the same age, maybe a bit older, when I was doing a theatre summer school and I was given the part of a part or something. I had a funny line about Margaret Thatcher. That dates me. I had a funny line about Margaret Thatcher. And I had to go on and say, oh, I don't know, here are some men from the government sent by the lady herself. And I didn't get it.
Yeah.
But the director told me how to say it, yes, in order to make the joke work. And I did. And I remember on the day when obviously all the parents and guardians came, everyone laughed.
You got to laugh.
And I had another moment of going, oh, they think I know. They think I've made the joke here. So if I know how to say this or I know how to present it, I can communicate with a whole other, like I can kind of move in a world above myself, beside myself, make myself look different, be different, sound different. And for me, that was like just a wonderful escape. I got a job as the actor in residence at a school called Christ Hospital, which is down in West Sussex, which is an extraordinary school. They all wear tweed uniform and march into lunch every day. Mad. Brilliant.
Oh, amazing.
Wonderful. And I was the actor in residence there for a year, which was a treat. And they had this Romania project as part of their kind of community work. I don't think, even if someone had told me what it was, I couldn't have understood until I was there. So we went to live in this orphanage for a couple of weeks in this place called Slobozia. And then the idea was to work with the kids there. So I was there with a couple of English children, children from the school. And then we had some local teenagers who came to be translators. And I remember asking, like, one of the drama teachers there, what, you know, in it back at the school, you know, what should I do? And he worked with a lot of Down syndrome people, and he was like, oh, do this, do that. So I went out with a whole plan, like a name game, you know, hello. Mm. So first of all, clap your hands and say your name. And then we got out there and it was like, we can't all clap our hands, we can't all stand up, we can't all say our name. Mm. We just have to rethink this completely. And actually, I used to work, help out with my mum's in her ballet school.
Yeah.
With her classes. So I ended up doing a lot of stuff based on kind of nonverbal and music things. And then every year, so I went back for 5 years after that, every year I just wanted to do better. So the kids we were working with were teenagers mostly, considered to be special needs in quotes. So they were in this particular orphanage. They were mostly considered to be autistic spectrum, although that's, you know...
And they had lived in orphanages?
Mostly for most of their lives.
Okay. So, I mean, would it be fair to say that some of those behaviours would have been, you know, I don't know how much the orphanages have changed in the last sort of 20 years, but...
I think what you might think of when you remember some of those videos that were... So we were looking at those kind of things. So some were just kind of entirely nonverbal. Not that they were mute, not that they couldn't speak, but that it was safer for them not to speak. Mm. So there were kind of significant conditions affecting their movement and their speech, lots of traumatic past experiences, and the carers would beat them, often wouldn't make direct eye contact, didn't want to be physically touched, had a kind of whole sexual disinhibition thing. A lot of them had been abused,
right.
Or a lot of them would kind of openly start masturbating or things.
Yeah.
So kind of like obsessive gestures, repetitive gestures.
Yeah.
And reluctant, obviously, to participate in anything, and often very, very hungry, and just prone to kind of lashing out. So it was a really interesting environment to work in. But what I realised over my time there, we didn't have all the things one might rely on with a group of kids here or something. You know, let's all imagine we're this, or let's all imagine we're that, or let's all pretend. There, they had so little access to...
They didn't have those experiences.
No, or necessarily access to those reference points.
Yes.
And so we literally had ourselves. What we have is our bodies and our expressions and our voices. And those are the things we had in common. So that was the work we did. Often the things people might take out to them would just get stolen. So there was no point taking anything. Mm. That made us look lovely. Oh, we brought you these lovely things. It would just go.
Yeah.
And anything that you brought would be destroyed. They would destroy. So, and the work would be taken away, because I felt some cases, you know, the authorities or the orphanage authorities were very much sort of humouring us, but there was a sense of danger. You know, there were definite physical dangers and definite serious punishments that the the children were subject to, the children and young people were subject to, that were terrifying, that we could only protect them from a very short time.
And there was a sense, presumably, from the staff that you were in there observing things that, you know, that they would rather you didn't observe, if you weren't seeing the full extent of it.
I don't know. I've seen, you know, kids being beaten up horribly by big men who didn't seem that worried. And we would have kids, you know, ask us for help because they were being taken away by men in cars and, you know, all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, stories and stories and stories, as I'm sure you can imagine. But for me, I thought the work I need to do, needs to be in with the kids directly. Mm. That needs to be part of our experience, because anything that isn't in them can be taken away from them.
Okay.
So we really need to think about engaging with them as people and not making them do things, but looking at them and thinking about them and working with them and communicating, and saying to them that they're important, that their contribution was important, and that there was no point us being there unless they were in the room, and to have moments where we could say to them, well done, you know, you're brilliant, or communicate or learn something or be part of a story.
Mm.
And not be teaching, but just be experiencing with them. And that work had to be done in their heads and in their bodies, and not through objects, which I know is funny because they ended up doing puppetry, but puppetry was really just the medium for that, the conduit for that, because there were so many other barriers really to participation. But actually then it wasn't about the constant drip feed of language either. It was about gesture and about body language and about music and about communication and not instruction all the time.
Which for non-verbal traumatized children could be an amazing approach.
Yeah, hey? You can't fake kind of sincerity really. And I think I just wanted to share that space with them. So we basically developed kind of rod puppets, really simple rod puppets, and kind of bunraku style, so multiple person puppets. And that started, so it was very much about what kids could do, really. Did they have access to, you know, could they do these things? Did they want to do these things? Mm. And how could we accommodate the huge variety of different skills and abilities in the room?
Mm.
Because there were some kids there who'd just been sort of in that orphanage, they didn't have any special needs, and they were very frustrated by other kids who couldn't.
Right.
So, you know, you're trying to accommodate a huge spectrum of teenagers, mostly teenage boys. So it kind of developed, and I was at the time living with a friend who was a prop maker, and we ended up making puppets specifically to take out to Romania. So we made, we moulded latex heads, and I made sure that they didn't have eyes. They've got kind of eye spaces, but they weren't looking at you directly. They didn't have mouths particularly, so they weren't talking puppets. They were very much directional, so they're friendly looking, but they've just got noses, so we can tell where they're looking.
So is that sort of sense then that they can be anyone and anything that you want them to be, that you're not making them too specific, so there's a lot of space there for people to choose who they want them to be.
Yeah, and you're not telling the story already. You're not going, this is where the puppet's looking, or this is what the puppet, you know, it has a mouth so it must speak. You're not saying that. You're just saying this is an object. Let's just play with this object.
Right.
So we kind of molded them in, we coloured the latex, so we made them in very like greens and browns, so very kind of colours. We made sure it was coloured, not painted, because often the kids would put them in their mouths so they could wash them, you know, wipe them down and stuff. And then we made bodies, made them kind of detachable from the bodies. I mean, we made really, so yeah, no choke hazards as well. That was huge. So everything, you know, just stuff that was obvious really, but I had never made puppets like that before. And then I was discovering, actually, a lot of people were bringing, there were other classes, there were music classes and kind of art, other things going on in other rooms. But often the kids would destroy things, they would break things. And that involved, you know, like killing small animals and things. Mm. They would just break stuff. And I discovered through trial and error that just by bringing a puppet to the groups and saying, this is, look at it, it's this, it's that, describing what it was and saying it's nothing special, it's only special when it's in your hand, it's only special when we move it together, they wouldn't destroy it then, because it wasn't my special thing, it was it was something that we were all playing with. Mm. So it was a process.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Really interesting. Some astonishing things, kids that have never spoken before, speaking, you know, extraordinary kids that you didn't think were paying attention at all, suddenly engaging and doing something so specific that you went, oh God, you're absolutely in this room.
Yeah.
Hello yeah. Person in there. And also realizing how, however kind of weak they looked, that these were absolutely the strongest people, and that a lot of these coping mechanisms were about protecting themselves. And
that made absolute sense.
Oh, huge sense.
Yeah.
So a real respect for those, for everyone.
Yeah.
And a real, just a desire to, I think just as a desire to share and to say to them, I see you.
Thank you so much, Naomi.
Thank you.
Claire, what do you think?
Well, the thing about Naomi's story is that she was definitely the right person in the right place, wasn't she? There wasn't really a right time because it's just something that was ongoing.
Yeah.
But I just feel that what she did there was something that she sort of fell into, but was also something that very few people could have done.
And what do you mean? What sort of way?
Well, the skills to understand how to communicate with these young people. They were nonverbal and there was no sort of way of using many props.
Mm.
But also just having the resilience not to be overwhelmed by that situation.
Yeah, true, yeah.
It's like one of those challenges where you think, okay, they can't talk that well and we have nothing to sort of use, so let's mime. And then you realise that they don't have the capacity to, like, imagine a snail or, like...
Yeah, she kind of talked about, you know, not having those shared points of reference even.
Yeah, so it must have just been so challenging and upsetting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you just really struggle with the fact that these disabilities were caused by neglect and cruelty, essentially, and not, you know, they could have been prevented.
Mm.
But I do like the idea that sometimes you can be, I'm not sure if it's ever happened to me, but you can be the right person in the right place.
Mm, yeah.
Have you ever had one of those times, Susie?
What, being the right person in the right place? Definitely not. No, I've probably been the wrong one a few times. I'm just thinking, yeah, there was a time when years ago my neighbour's cat had been missing for, you know, a good few days, and I saw her on the street and she was really kind of frantic about her missing cat. So I said, okay, you know, I'll give you a hand, and basically found the cat within you know, the first few minutes.
Oh, wow. Where was it?
It was in a garage over the road, which I just thought was the most bleeding obvious place for a cat to be hiding out. That's where I would go.
Of course it's in the garage.
Yeah, of course it is.
I thought it might have been up a tree.
No, but she was convinced that I was, you know, some sort of psychic cat whisperer.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there we go. Right person, right place.
I'll know who to call when I lose my cat. Naomi was working with teenagers, which is, you know, sort of notoriously difficult age group to work with.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah, I used to work with teenagers. I think they get a really bad rap, don't they?
Yeah.
You know, I've never experienced anything to the extent that Naomi describes, but I did used to do outreach work around drugs and alcohol, and worked with some really, really difficult kind of disengaged teenagers. But I love them. I absolutely love them. I love that kind of, you know, attitude where they can't stand you and they're calling you all the names under the sun. And eventually you kind of, you know, but, you know, then you kind of earn their trust. And I like teenagers. I think they're going through a very difficult transitional stage. And, you know, we need to cut them a bit of slack sometimes, don't we?
Definitely.
And I know you've done work with teenagers as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I've done my fair share of, well, probably not a fair share, but yeah, I went to South Africa actually filming with a bunch of teenagers.
Okay.
And that they were kids who'd left care. That was quite challenging at times.
Yeah.
Probably not a good idea to take kids from Southeast London to Johannesburg.
In at the deep end.
Yeah. but it was really interesting. And it's always challenging but kind of fun. And but obviously these guys that she's working with are like on a different level, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, a huge level of need. I asked Naomi what happened to the work that she had developed, and she'd actually been able to write it up into a teaching program. So that could be, you know, followed up by other workers in Romania. So it's good to know that that work hasn't been lost.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. I was, you know, kind of going back to her story, I was really struck by how she was able to think on her feet. You know, she went out to Romania, she'd done her preparation, had some ideas about how to work with these young people. And then, you know, basically that all went completely out of the window, didn't it, when she found out that many of them were non-verbal. You know, what else did you kind of take from her story?
Yeah, I mean, I like the way that she doesn't pigeonhole herself.
Okay.
Like, she's a performer and academic and does direct work with young people. I mean, I think probably to be a successful actor of any type, like, you need to be able to be, you know, very like good at sort of changing roles and
yeah
sort of
you
thing,
need that
you?
Kind of agility and flexibility. Yeah,
she's definitely got that, hasn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she has. Yeah. I think kind of inevitably hearing her experience, you know, made me think about all of the backstories of the children in those orphanages.
Yeah.
and what had become of them. So I had a look online, and there's a really great Guardian article which we'll put into the show notes about this guy. I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher his name, so I apologise for that, but I think it's pronounced Vishnel Balan. Anyway, that's how I'm going to pronounce it. And basically,
I'm not going to correct you.
No. He was born in 1987, and when he was just a baby, just a couple of months old, he was put into a state infant centre. And he describes remembering rocking himself backwards and forwards and waking up warm, you know, basically because he peed himself. And then when he was 3 years old, he was sent to a preschool institution where the children were beaten on the soles of their feet for wetting the bed. So, you know, still a tiny little boy.
Wow.
Then when he was 8, he moved again. And within a year, he'd run away to the railway station. So, you know, you can only imagine how bad things must have been for him to feel that he'd fare better by himself. He kind of moved around, lived in lots of different places. There was a monastery in the woods and a foster family where the mother beat him. But then kind of by chance, he met two of his brothers and was able to build a bond with one of them.
Oh, wow.
And with this brother, he eventually set up a charity to help teenagers. And, you know, he's done really well. And I was so kind of interested and surprised by his story, because I guess you kind of assume that children who haven't had that loving and caring environment in their really early years are beyond help. But
yeah,
clearly, you know, this guy has an amazing success story. I think he set up a charity where he went to university and then set up a charity which employs 35 people and helping teenagers. And I think he sees his role very much as demonstrating that, you know, people can write their own future, that, you know, they're in charge of their own future. So,
God, just, do you think it's just like a remarkable character that enables you to be able to do that?
Well, you know, I guess you've got to have those qualities of resilience and grit.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's incredible. So, as I say, we'll put the link to that in our show notes because it's definitely worth reading up on.
That's really cool, yeah. And by the way, do you know how all the kids ended up in the orphanages? Because I, whilst we were researching this, I found out why, and it's just fascinating. I think because I was like 11 when, you know, this all came out.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, I didn't really sort of realise quite what had been going on before.
Okay.
So basically, this is a nutshell description because I know I'm going off tangent here, but I just thought it might be of interest to people that
yeah.
in 1966, Ceausescu had grand plans for Romania when he came to power. And he kind of borrowed from that 1930 Stalinist dogma that population growth would fuel economic growth.
Okay.
So basically he put in loads of different like things to make that happen. So the birth rate soon doubled, but then the rate of increase slowed as Romanian women resorted to like homemade illegal abortions,
mm-hmm.
which obviously they often had catastrophic results.
Oh, God, yeah.
Then they slapped a tax on childless people. Soon they banned the pill and condoms, and basically motherhood became this like state duty.
Oh my God.
The system was ruthlessly enforced by the secret police. Doctors who performed abortions were imprisoned. Women were examined every 3 months in their workplaces for signs of pregnancy. And if they were found to be pregnant and didn't subsequently give birth, then they could face prosecution.
Wow.
And basically, this policy, which was obviously coupled with Romania's poverty, which is also a massive element of it, meant that more and more unwanted children were abandoned into state care. And no one knows how many, but estimates for around 100,000 kids at the start of 1989 were in orphanages.
I'm sure that's an underestimate.
I don't
think
it's quite low,
are,
yeah. But after 1982, when Ceausescu redirected most of the budget to paying off the national debt, basically the economy tanked and the conditions in the orphanages like went even further downhill.
God.
Electricity and heat were often intermittent. There were not enough staff. There was all sorts of abuse going on. Physical needs were assessed, but emotional needs were ignored. And basically that's how, like, you know, what was revealed in 1989 came to pass.
Yeah, and it didn't stop in 1989, you know, as evidenced by these children that Naomi was working with.
Yeah.
You know, I think things are still bad, but, you know, they are improving. I know that the state has been trying to close down the institutions, but I think there's a risk now of people falling through the gaps. And another link that we'll put up is to a charity that Naomi supports, which does outreach work and sort of supported living for young people, you know, who are basically being kicked out of the institutions and will have nowhere else to go, you know, would otherwise end up living on the street. So
great.
We'll
you
put
that
link
in our show notes.
Put that link in the show notes.
So before we forget, do we have a podcast recommendation this week?
Yeah, we do. It's this week. It's the Reith Lectures
Love a
Reith Lecture, which they're put out by the BBC. They're put out annually, and I'm pretty sure that they're always done in a series of four. Previous ones have included, previous Reith Lecturers have included Grayson Perry and Hilary Mantel. Don't know if you heard either of those.
Yep, I listened to Hilary's last year.
And this year it's the historian Margaret Macmillan. She's talking about war and conflict.
Mm.
And really, they are so worth a listen. They're an absolute delight and they're completely accessible. And I think what I like about them is that because you have this one lecturer working over a series of four lectures, you kind of get the opportunity to have, you know, these themes and ideas being really expanded.
Yeah,
and you really, you kind of feel like you're going into something in, you know, in a bit of depth, which, you know, is a bit of an antidote, isn't it, to everything being presented to us in these bite-sized chunks. So yeah, Reith Lectures available as a podcast, highly recommended.
Excellent, thanks for that.
So no clip this week because Claire, both of your children have now had chickenpox, haven't
Yay.
They? And you've been on holiday, so officially we are flying by the seat of our pants.
We are, but we will be posting on the Backstory Podcast on Facebook and Instagram and at the Backstory Pod on Twitter with news of next week's podcast just as soon as we've got it ready. Search for The Backstory with Claire and Susie in your trusted podcast directory and hit subscribe. I gather that a recommendation on Apple Podcasts will really help us.
Okay, nobody ever mentions that.
No, they never mention it.
No, absolutely.
But if you do review us, then big thanks.
We will be back next Tuesday, come hell or high water, with a brand new backstory. Hope to see you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.